Hi everyone, before we start the show today, I wanted to extend a special invitation to all the Own the Build listeners to a live event that Sealink will be hosting. That event is on the 9th of May, it's going to be held at midday, it will be online. You can find details of the event in the show notes now and you can sign up. In short, we'll have a construction lawyer, we'll have professionals from both main and subcontract experiences, and we will be talking about digital tenders, digital contracts and digital e-signatures. What that can bring to your business, how it can reduce project risk, and why you should be using them. We'd love to see you there. And I will, like I said, put a link in the show notes, hit the link, find more information out, and you can then join us on the 9th of May at midday. Anyway, on to today's show. Enjoy.
You are now tuning in to the Own the Build podcast. Join Sealink's very own Paul Hemming, where each week he interviews experts from the world of construction and asks all the important questions around intelligent construction management.
Hello and welcome to episode 165 of the Own the Build podcast with me, Paul Hemming. Today in the show notes, I'm sharing a free final account statement template with you. It does what it says on the tin, guys, and it gives you a template for safely wrapping up and concluding a final account agreement with your supply chain. It segues me delightfully onto today's show, which is all kind of about final accounts, negotiations, emotional intelligence, all of the good stuff. And in the studio today, I am joined by an Own the Builder, Ray Mellor-Pike, who is a QS and managing director of his own consultant QS practice. I've been speaking to Ray for a while, and today we're going to be talking about the final account process, negotiations generally, and the show is titled Final Account Meetings, How an FBI Hostage Negotiator's Tactics Impact My Approach. And Ray is smirking already. How's it going, Ray? Nice to have you on the show, mate.
Yeah, it's great to be on the show. Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. Very well, up to my ears in QS-related work. I'm a total QS nerd and can't get enough of it, really.
Well, QS nerd is not a bad... You're not in bad company in some respect, Ray. And we're very happy to have QS nerds on the show because I very much am one myself. So I've introduced you, mate. Do me a favour. For everyone listening, just talk to us about your long and winding construction journey and your experience to lead you here today almost.
Yeah, sure. So I've got roughly sort of the best part of 22 years experience in the construction industry. That's spread across consultancy, residential, main contracting and subcontracting alike. So I've sort of abridged kind of all four of your key parts of the construction industry. Yeah, across my time in each of those sort of respective sectors, I've seen just about as much as you would expect to see in terms of the colorful world of construction. I've now got my own business, as you kindly alluded to, which is RMP Consultant Southern Limited. Southern being because some other clever chap managed to actually get the RMP Consulting Limited name before
Damn
I
it.
Managed to get the. I know, I was gutted. When I went to register on Company's House, I was a bit disappointed. Nevertheless, anyway, I do live in the south of England, so it's quite fitting. So yeah, I've got my own business now, doing kind of the mainstay of all your classic nuts and bolts QS work. But, you know, much of what we're going to be touching on today is obviously to do with, you know, stuff that's of an overtly contractual nature, you know, dealing with dispute resolution, contract negotiations, all that sort of stuff. And that's kind of like where my heart really lies. So, you know, it probably makes up roughly about half my work, and the rest of it is just your standard QS type stuff, which I equally enjoy as well. And it helps to keep you have one foot in that pond, as it were, as well.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's good. And is, I might be jumping to conclusions here, but is, I know that you work for some really, really large companies during your time, and obviously now working, setting up your own consultancy, it's quite the opposite, right? Is there something in the fact that, and I almost talked to my own experience here, but also other people that I've spoken to who've done similar, that you're now doing the bits that you like rather than the reporting and all of the bits that you didn't like so much. Is that a fair reflection?
Yeah, it's interesting. It always used to be that looming CVR report that used to come once a month, you know, that you'd sort of, you'd prepare for it throughout the month, but whenever it came around, you'd you were never really massively looking forward to it because you would always be burning the candle at both ends to sort of capture everything that you did. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff in the job that on a day-to-day basis was not your favorite stuff to do. But now that I've operating my own business, I'm definitely doing a lot more of the type of work that I really find enjoyment in. Like when I was last working for a main contractor, I wasn't getting to deal with nearly as much contractual stuff as I like to deal with. And I love being in front of a contract or, you know, unraveling a dispute and going through the discovery phase.
You really are a QS nerd.
The journey that it takes you on.
I love being in front of a contract.
Oh, goodness, I think that
might be the ultimate line that I've ever captioned on Own the Build after 165 episodes.
Positively heavenly. So I do a lot more of that type of work, which is really why I got into what I'm doing now, because I find so much enjoyment in helping people, you know, on a day-to-day basis. So that, you know, with my clientele, I really enjoy sort of assisting them maneuver through the landmine-laden world that is construction. And equally, all the same, I really enjoy the type of work that I'm doing now, probably far more than what I was doing before. So it's good.
No, that's brilliant. And could you describe how you touched on the fact that you've almost been in all the different key sectors or segments, maybe is a better way of putting it, of quantity surveying, right? Could you just describe like how having been a PQS, then a house builder, then how like that impacts you? Because I very much recognize that personally, I'm this blinkered subcontractor in many ways, because that is my total experience in some respects. So can you just talk about that?
Yeah, so I started life as a consultant working for a PQS practice for the best part of 3.5 years, and I really enjoyed that. And it actually gave me a really solid grounding in QS principles, and also, you know, having moved over from Canada, you know, when I first joined a PQS practice, they're like, barely anyone can understand what you're saying, and so we're going to have to give you a crash course in the Queen's English. So I got
really,
I got a rapid sort of level of teaching of how to speak properly, you know, in terms of, you know, as far as English people are concerned. So that was really interesting, and actually set a really solid foundation for the rest of my working career. I then moved to a house builder for probably the best part of 3 years. And that was quite interesting. And I got to see a little bit more of a live construction world, but still very much sort of office-based. So not as much as you would normally see with main contracting. And then when I moved into the main contracting world, I think that's probably when those are my real sort of formative years in construction. In as much that I was just on a site 24/7, well, not 24/7, 8 hours a day or longer, you know. And as you're seeing a building go up before your eyes and you're managing all the subcontractors, it changes the way that you think about construction. You wield contracts differently because you have multiples of them. So, you know, on a given site, you know, there's some sites that we worked on that were fairly large and, you know, had the best part of, you know, 100 subcontractors across. So in doing so, you just see all facets of construction, and you start to view the world wildly differently than you did when you were a PQS or working for a residential contractor. And then after the best part of 11 years in main contracting, I went back to a little bit of house building, but it was almost sort of like brownfield site house building where you had sort of high-rise buildings. So the site that I was, well, high-rise-ish, you know, the site that I was working on had sort of 3 11-story buildings that were all sort of concrete frame. So, you know, it was a decent-sized site, probably about £60 million. So that was really good. And that was just prior to COVID. And then when COVID hit, I went and worked for, you're going to love this, Paul, went and worked for a facade contractor.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, I figured that would scratch all the itches for you.
Should we cancel this now? We've sorted it.
I've
achieved
there
what I wanted to.
You got the maximum satisfaction within the first 10 minutes.
I'm that basic, aren't I? You've listened. You know how basic I am.
Yeah, I've listened to a lot of Own the Build, so I know where you're coming from. I was managing QS with a facade contractor for a little while, and that was really interesting because I just saw such a wide cross-section of main contracts, subcontract agreements, and I was already in the mindset that I loved working with contracts, already had my own business going as a bit of a side hustle, you know, just dealing with the odd dispute, reading the odd contracts for a subcontractor. And then it was just kind of like reading subcontracts on speed, really, because you were seeing terms and conditions coming across all the time from a pre-construction standpoint. You're reading the contracts before you start on site, negotiating the terms. And the chap that I was working for at the time, when it came to sort of the contractual stuff, he was borderline genius, really knew his stuff. And I learned a lot in my time at that business and changed the way that I thought about construction, because I think subcontracting was the last sort of part of the industry that I had been exposed to. And when I was exposed to it, it just changed the way that I thought about the industry. I think particularly because I saw how hard a subcontractor has to work to make things happen on site in terms of you'll know full well, having sort of been in the facade world, you have just a mountain of design, the challenges to get over on any particular job. And if you're owning the whole of the facade. So if you're dealing with SFS outwards and you're managing curtain walling and windows and steel doors, maybe, you could be managing the whole kit and caboodle. And if you are, you could have umpteen amount of different curtain walls on a particular site. And so your design managers are absolutely taxed out. And also from a ordering standpoint, you're ordering so much material and so many varied types of material that you're really down in the weeds. You're in the minutia. And so I think suddenly I realized how much I took for granted as a main contractor, where you might be ordering 60 to 70 subcontract packages, but each of those subcontractors are actually doing probably a lot more heavy lifting than you are, because they're looking at something in a much more intricate way than you are. So that really changed my view of the industry, probably for the better, really.
Yeah, no, I think you literally have covered every base in some respects, which is why your experience is really interesting. And like I said, mine is incredibly limited. It's not even, I've worked for two facade contractors. That's it, right? So I'm incredibly niche in that respect. Just, this is maybe a bit of a tongue-in-cheek question, but which of the four, well, in fact, let's just have PQS, main contractor, and subcontractor, each have their own challenges, each have their own unique nuance. Like, is there one which stands out to you as the most complicated, or like, do they all feel really similar in terms of like how difficult it is to, in inverted commas, QS them?
I felt the most pressure in the subcontract world.
Okay.
Purely because...
Correct answer.
Yeah, you love it. I really felt the most pressure in the subcontract world, just because the pace at which things moved felt more frenetic than the other parts of the industry. And I suppose the thing that I could liken it to when I was in the main contracting world is I spent a period of time when I was at Morgan's Indoor working in the special works division, because I was between sort of two large main contract jobs. And the time that I spent in special works, I had all the respect in the world for those guys when I came out of it, because I was like, man, this world moves so fast. When you're working on a large construction project, it's like big ships turn slowly and you have a lot of time to think about your procurement. When I was in the subcontract world, and again, I was kind of at the MQS position, so I wasn't really at the pointy end of the wedge, but I saw with the personnel that I had the privilege of managing that they're under an awful lot of pressure to ensure that all the components that need to be delivered to site on time were there on time, if not beforehand. Because if you don't deliver when you need to deliver on the job, as we all well know, talking about what we're talking about today, is that you suddenly can land in a bit of a claim scenario, or you're in a position where you're defending yourself from penalties under the contract. And so you are really at the exposed pointy end of the wedge at times as a subcontractor. And so I've got a lot of sympathy now for subcontractors in terms of actually what they have to maneuver through. And also because, as much as I quite like the fact what Kian Brennan said on one of your previous episodes, and I think he probably actually said it more than once, was that subcontractors get the most onerous contract terms in the industry. So not only do you have all the pressure in the world to deliver, but the contracts that you're trying to deliver under,
you've probably got the least amount of resource in order to be able to actually manage that incredibly onerous contract. I completely agree with you, and it echoes with my own experience. I mean, it's funny because I asked that question really tongue-in-cheek, because it's difficult no matter who you are, right? And particularly in contracting, whether main or sub, in my experience. And Chris Barber, my business partner, I asked him that question on one of the episodes, and he said, having done main and subcontracting, said main contracting easily. He really thought it was main contracting, and I was a bit perturbed because I wanted him to say subcontracting like you did, but it's a bit in jest to even ask that question. But it's interesting just to hear your experience, because that's kind of how I would feel about it, particularly on the contractual side of things. Anyway, so great conversation. I mean, we haven't even got to the heart of what I wanted to talk about today. So you have kindly written for us today a blog, which is going out with the episode, which talks about resolving disputes through developing relationships. And, you know, the title of the show is How an FBI Hostage Negotiator's Tactics Impact Your Approach to Negotiation at Final Accounts and in Meetings Generally. This is a topic which, now you mentioned Kian Brennan, we talked about it with Kian Brennan, and we talked about he has like a framework for managing disputes, et cetera, et cetera. Before we get into what is maybe like your framework and your approach generally, can I just ask you to talk about, without mentioning company names and again, whether you can maybe main contract, subcontract, whatever, like some of the difficult disputes that you've had in your career and therefore why you wrote about this, why this is a topic that you feel so passionate to discuss it about?
Yeah, sure. One comes to mind, actually, and it doesn't really follow the pattern of the way that I naturally like to operate. So the way that I particularly like to deal with and operate in a dispute type setting is to make it more like a mediation rather than like a punch in the face contest. You know, the classic, you know, good old JCT 1980s sort of dispute style is really not my cup of tea if I can avoid it.
Me neither, believe it or not.
Yeah. But in this particular instance, and you'll sort of see actually in the blog that I wrote for the episode, was that the hope is that you can manage a dispute through relationships. The hope is that you can leverage that relationship in both directions to move yourself to a workable outcome. What you often find is that in a successful negotiation, both parties usually feel a little bit hard done by, because that means that there was some level of satisfaction, but also they are both slightly perturbed that they didn't get the golden outcome.
Sound of a good deal, and it's what people say,
isn't
it?
Quite often, yeah. And it's interesting because people would say, well, yeah, but surely you should be looking to rinse the other party. And in one sense, you know, you are looking for the best result that you can acquire through a negotiation, but that's often not there to be had. And you have a party on the other side of the table you have to work with. Now, in this particular negotiation, no matter what I did to try and build a relationship with the other party, there just was that feeling of collaboration wasn't being reciprocated whatsoever.
Yeah, I've been there.
Yes. And so we got into a scenario where we were effectively just deferring to good old record keeping and letter writing. And, you know, we would preface those letters and emails by, you know, a telephone call to say, hey, by the way, you know, we don't really want to be sending this letter or delivering this notice, but in accordance with your contract, you know, we're required to, and, you know, the whole nine, you know. And, you know, I actually really like the wording that Kian used about using semi-submissive sort of wording. That was in a tender setting, I think, that he was talking about it, but it works well in any faculty, really. And so, you know, we were, you know, as gentlemanly as we could be, as polite as we could be, and we were just not maneuvering to an agreed position at all. You know, application after application would go in, and the result would be all the same items would get knocked out on a monthly basis. There was no movement. But what I advised my client was, look, if you cannot get the other party to come to the table, contractually, you just need to keep doing everything that you're supposed to do. And what we will do is we will flank the other party by setting up a mountain of records that become irrefutable, almost like circumstantial evidence. That when you put it all together, it's like a puzzle piece. It's, you know, it's the picture that paints a thousand words, as it were. And at that stage, they won't have anywhere to hide. And if we do have to threaten pushing the button, you know, the scorched earth policy of going to adjudication, then we will, but
it's
we don't
want to be worth their while.
Yeah, and we don't want to go there. And we maintain that position all along. We didn't really so much use the word adjudication, or we just, you know, it's more sort of, we don't want to end up in a protracted dispute with you. It was kind of the angle that we took. And sure enough, anyway, you know, we got 6 months down the line. It really was the long game. There comes a point in a negotiation where your window of opportunity is open, that where you have the leverage. If you're in a place where the other party will not play ball with you, you then have to use your leverage. You know, it's kind of minimum force applied, you know, is the order of the day. But at some point, yeah, I think is it that that quote from that movie, 1980s movie Roadhouse, you know, you play nice until it's time to not play nice, or something along those lines. And so we got to the point where that window was wide open. The leverage was ours. And I was like, okay, now is the time you need to float the A word.
Can I ask, what was that window of opportunity? Like how, because there'll be people listening and there'll be some obvious ones, but like, how do you spot your window of opportunity in some respects?
Yeah, sometimes it's actually self-evident. It's at that point in the negotiation where you're almost at a bit of a crescendo, like that. If you know, if you don't pull the trigger, then the leverage starts to leak out of the situation. Like you get closer to like a final account situation where suddenly they have the leverage. And it depends, like, also what money is traded hands at what point, you know, how much is outstanding on the account. So it's very circumstantial to actually identify.
Where are you on the program? You'd kind of know when you became less important. As soon as you hit watertight, that is never quite as simple as that. But, you know, when watertight came along, attention moved on as a main. That's how I always felt about it. Main contractor, facade's done. It's watertight. Let's crack on with the fit out. Let's focus our energy and our money and our time there. I know that's not truly the case, but that's how we viewed it.
Yeah. Well, you're speaking in general terms, which is exactly right. Like, you know, it's usually when the convolution of all of those circumstances, program, what money is exchanged hands, you know, what variations are agreed or aren't agreed, you get to a stage where you're like, you just got feel like now's the time. And if we don't do it now, we start to lose that leverage. It starts to slip away from us. And so we got to that moment that we perceived that the leverage was ours. So we said, look, if we can't get any resolution with this, you know, within a period of 7 days, then we will consider referring this to adjudication. And as soon as we mentioned the A word, it was like it just went up the pyramid and down the pyramid as fast as you could ever imagine. 95% of the outstanding money on the account got released. And it was just like the floodgates opened. But it was, I think, largely because we had painted such a lucid picture of
how that
what reality looked
would
like.
Go.
Yeah. It's like, we know it's going to be a landslide, guys. You know, I know nothing's ever a given when you enter, you know, the world of adjudication. But if you were to put your money on it, you'd be like, if I was a betting man, we were in a pretty solid position at that stage.
It's interesting listening to you talk about that. And it's quite interesting in that some ways that example that you give, I think, isn't necessarily like the example of what we're actually going to talk about in this show. That, like, because you're actually going to talk about emotional intelligence, actually, when you've built this relationship with someone so that you don't get there. But interestingly enough, the entire approach which you just described kind of is the approach I took to every single project, in that I always thought I am going to do my absolute best to become, in inverted commas, best mates with this main contract US or whoever on the other side. I'm going to build a great relationship with them that is going to be personal. It's going to be more than just business. We're going to be friends. I'm going to understand who they are, what makes them tick, and I'm going to make sure I do a good job for them first and foremost. But also, I'm going to have an absolute ton of record keeping, and I'm going to tell them from the out off that I'm going to have a ton of record keeping and to expect it. And it's, some of it's for me, some of it's for you, some of it's for us, whatever, that's going to happen. And 4 times out of 5, maybe, you know, it'd be pretty good relationship throughout, unless something went dramatically wrong that was kind of out of my hands, that the business failed or, you know, something like that, or the project was just one of those projects. And it usually worked, but there's moments in my career where you do the exact same thing happened to me, which was, I cannot build a relationship with this individual for love or money, right? And that might be to do with me, might be to do with them, might be to do with the fact of the external pressures that we both have on us. But irrespective, I'm going to have that ton of information in my back pocket. So that it's exactly that same thing, isn't it? Like, so when we sit down month on month, quarter by quarter, year after year, whatever it is, however long the project is, some of mine did take years, you are probably going to think it's not worth it. That was kind of my approach. And in some ways, it shows kind of who we are as an industry, doesn't it? That is your approach. But that, so what you're saying really echoes with me. Anyway, very interesting start to the show. After the break, we're going to talk about like an alternative approach, and we will do that shortly. In construction today, a severe shortage of trades has become the norm. We talk about it a lot on the show, but for a main contracting business to thrive, you must create an environment that attracts subcontractors. At SeaLink, we've worn the hats of subbies, main contractors, and we genuinely know what both sides needs. For main contractors, effective pre-qual is the linchpin of your success on any project. If you had real-time data on your supply chain's insurance, accreditations and financials, and even a wider pool of subcontractors to speak to, that would empower decision-making. For subcontractors, they want to receive comprehensive tenders with everything that they need to give you a good price. If you do that, you will massively increase your tender return rates. So, if you're a main contractor and you want to learn how to access real-time pre-qual data, grow your supply chain and deliver world-class tenders, you need to see SeaLink. To find out more, you will be able to click a video in the show notes right now and also book a demo to speak to one of our team. We look forward to speaking to you soon. Okay, Ray. So really good start to the show. We've talked a lot there about the basics, I think, really, of construction, nuance, negotiation, the kind of like the path that you navigate. In the second half of the show, as per what you've written about, as per what we've discussed about, we are going to talk about tactical empathy. And I hope that that is the two words that everyone is kind of comes away from at the end of the show, because that's kind of what I came away from talking with you originally. And I'm just going to exemplify it by reminding everyone of like a story from my career without names, where I talked about this with Kian Brennan and you said, oh, are you talking about the no shoes guy? Right. So if you haven't listened to that show, scroll back. I am talking about the no shoes guy. And in short, to paraphrase this as quickly as I can, I got brought into a project which was 60, 70% complete, maybe even 80 or 90% complete. Still another 6 months left to run. We were the subcontractor. There was a main contractor. The two project teams just didn't like one another. It had been going on for a couple of years. Money wasn't flowing well. Arguments were flowing very well. And there was a lot of, there was no trust and there was next to no respect, to the point that there was a huge variation account. They would only agree to sit down with us Thursday night late, Friday afternoon late. And it was just a horrible environment. And my approach, well, number one, I wore shoes. Their QS didn't wear shoes. But we won't go into why he always didn't wear good, shoes, it means.
Always a good start. Make always, sure you're wearing shoes.
I find it's a good start. Yeah. He didn't find it was such a good start. But anyway, so my approach, right, was relatively basic in some ways now when I reflect on it, in that I thought, well, there's good guy, bad guy, right? It's as simple and as basic as that. I thought, well, look, there's a lot of bad energy in this room. I went to the first few meetings, just kind of watched it, saw what happened, didn't get too involved. And I thought, I'm just going to be the good guy. And that ended up being a project which the two good guys in the room ended up negotiating the final account. We just removed the bad guys. But it took a long time for us to get there. And it took, honestly, some horrible meetings that were very late at night and incredibly, incredibly toxic, like seriously toxic. And just talking to you now on reflection, I kind of think, well, I was like I said, it's probably pretty basic what my approach was to that. So in that circumstance, and on the topic of tactical empathy, those two words, how would you have maybe approached things differently?
Yeah, so I think it's always really difficult when you're entering a scenario where, let's say, you're three quarters the way through a project. The energy on the job is already pretty icy or toxic, as you referred to. And so, you know, I don't envy you. And I see it time and time again, actually, where I sort of enter the room at that stage and you're like, you know, everyone in here on the opposing side of the table, they all hate each other, you know.
And yeah, and that, it's mad, isn't it?
That's a really difficult place to start from. I think the probably the first thing that I would do is before the next meeting with the counterparts or the opposing side is I would have a meeting internally with my own team to say, we are going to make a concerted effort to build a relationship with the other side. Because if we are proverbially in trenches lobbing hand grenades at one another, this is probably all going to end in tears, or it's going to be painful right to the finish line. And no
that's
one,
a terrible reflection on us as well, right? As yeah, much as it is on them.
And so, you know, I've seen the good cop, bad cop sort of methodology work before. I think I've seen more success if you have a unified front, that no matter what the other side slings at you in the way of mud, that you're willing to just take it on the chin and build an understanding, or to actually show them that you understand. You understand where they're coming from. I think half the time, someone isn't looking to have their way entirely in a negotiation. Sometimes people just want to be understood. In fact, I think more often than not, people just want to be understood. And so in that sort of setting, if we can get a unified front amongst the team members that we're going to absolutely suck all the emotion out of this. So let's take all the oxygen out of the room in the way of emotion. And when we enter the room, we're now going to have a positive demeanor. If the other side is making inflammatory comments, we're not going to rise to the occasion, and we're not going to dive down the rabbit hole and have a tangle with them.
Tough, isn't it? Yeah. So you've got to be really committed to that and from the outset.
Absolutely. And I think the key thing that I often say to my clients, which is it's a Jocko Willink phrase, which is detachment is a superpower. So we need to, as soon as I can feel myself getting emotionally engaged in negotiation, I immediately push my chair back from the table and I sit back in my chair and I physically detach. And I look around the room. And I like, because you know, when you get emotionally involved, your vision narrows almost. You get target fixated, you know, and so you can feel like you're getting yourself pulled into it. You don't even,
And your blood starts to boil. That you can literally feel it, can't you?
Yeah, and you have your classic tells. And if you compare your classic tells with, I need to detach right now. So I will emotionally detach in that moment and think, I need to focus on what we're doing right now, because emotional decisions are rarely good decisions. You know, they almost always.
What do you mean, though? Because it's really interesting what you're saying there about. Because I like to focus quite a lot on body language, or I used to think that I did, right? If you were doing that in a meeting to me, I would, and you were on the opposite side, it would. I don't even know what it would do to me. I would definitely notice it. Yeah. And I would. I don't know whether I would take that as. He's mentally checked out and he doesn't want to be here, and whatever I'm saying is irrelevant to him. Like, how do you manage it?
I think it's largely shown by the expression on your face. So if someone says something that's a really emotionally loaded statement, it's meant to elicit a response out of you. If you sit back in your chair and you just keep a kind look on your face, or even a neutral look on your face, it's like they might actually be a bit puzzled that didn't have the desired response. Yeah, like it didn't land with you and that you didn't come out swinging, you know?
And particularly in construction, where we're used to it being, I'll go back to that experience. It was toxic, and one side wanted to create toxicity because that meant you didn't ever get to the nub of the issue.
Yeah, and you know, egos start flaring in a meeting, and before you know it, it's just a dust cloud, you know, and it's just into, you know, utter madness. And I think the key thing that we're looking to do in a negotiation or any negotiation setting is we're trying to disarm like the lizard brain, as it were. And what I mean by lizard brain, it's like the emotional brain, the emotionally loaded brain, where sometimes when you're emotionally loaded, you don't mind damaging the other party, even if it damages you, because you're emotional. And if we can starve the room of that oxygen, and we can get everyone using their higher thinking, we're much more likely to broker an agreement. But we're even much more likely, so going down the route of tactical empathy. So like, okay, if I can get everyone on board, let's not get emotional. We maybe have a key spokesperson that leads the meeting, so it doesn't turn into, you know, utter madness, as I was saying. And working along the principles of tactical empathy now is I'm now trying to ensure the other party feels understood. So it's simple things. And so the word tactical empathy, it's not my own. It's Christopher Voss, who was the lead hostage negotiator for the FBI. He used to come out of negotiations.
Here we go.
Yeah, his audiobook was life-changing, really, for me in this respect. I was like, oh my word, this guy's a genius. But his book, Never Split the Difference, for me was a bit of a life-changer, in that he used to come out of hostage negotiations where the hostage takers received no money, all the hostages were released, and almost like the hostage takers didn't even know why they were released. They almost feel like their brains have been hijacked. And so the principle of tactical empathy actually is a process where you let the other party do a lot of the talking. You don't interrupt them. You use simple things like mirroring and labeling. So mirroring being, so if you said, well, yeah, but all your operatives in room 2B, you know, they damaged all the partitions. If you say damaged all the partitions, you know, suddenly they're going to tell you more about that. And then you can get to a stage where you could, actually, at the end of that dialogue, you can say, that sounded like a really difficult situation to manage. That's a label. You're putting a label on it. And you're not suggesting you agree with them, but you're telling them that you understand where they're coming from. Yeah, and yeah. So what as the process that you go through is you're mirroring, labeling. Sometimes you might even use something like an accusation audit at the beginning. You know, Chris Voss talks about how powerful that can be, because sometimes if you're in a negotiation, you could say, you know, you're going to think at the end of this negotiation that we're the big bad contractor. You know, you think that we've been mistreating your company, you know, wholesale for however many years. You go through the what you perceive to be the accusations that they would levy against you. What you actually do by stating those at the front end, you state them properly, is you kind of just debarb the whole of their attack, and they almost sort of
completely
feel like
disarm the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah, and suddenly it's like, oh, we've got nothing emotional to talk about anymore, because you just basically you took the wind out of my sails. So there's kind of like simple tactics like that, and a lot of them, you know, this is something you kind of you build up the skill set over time, and you know, I'm by no means a master of it at all, but it's interesting that when you use it and you use it successfully, you're like, wow, it really works. And actually, ask earnest questions of the other side, and framing statements is so important. So when you deliver a statement, you know, I think we talked about indirect communication before. A direct communication being a statement that it could be really accusatory or blame-laden in the opposite direction. If you're using a statement that you have carefully framed for it to be non-accusatory at all and to send a message to the other side actually that you do understand or that you want to know more, what you're doing is you're unlocking that lizard brain slowly but surely. And then suddenly the real person comes out and you're like, oh, there they are. You know, and smiles start.
He's put shoes on, this guy. Can you believe
yeah,
it?
Yeah, suddenly the next meeting.
It's all changing.
Yeah, suddenly the next meeting, he's not barefooted. You're like, oh my word, we made a breakthrough.
He always wore socks, just so it's clear. He always wore socks, but still.
Still a step too far.
Yeah, I agree. Pun, like the pun.
So it's interesting, like you go through the process of letting them do as much talking as possible, and you use mirroring, you use labeling. And then you get to a stage where you feel like you've got a pretty good understanding of where they're coming from. And then you can summarize that back to them. And something that Chris Voss touches on, which I think is just completely genius, is that if you properly summarize that statement back to them, he knows when he hears the words in return, that's right. When you've got a that's right out of the other party, that's when some real negotiating can happen, because they feel understood. Yeah, he said, doesn't know what it is about the words, that's right, but it's wildly different than the word yes.
And so in some ways, there are some real echoes with what Kian was saying, right, about listen, don't respond, say that you understand, that you've gone through the process, but you're even like furthering it in some respects by just actually saying, right, I've listened to what you said, I'm going to put it back. Is my understanding correct? Is that right? And then you're trying to push to a point where they go, that's right.
Yeah. You have to go the long way around. So, and it reminds me of another podcast I listened to, which was a Jocko Willing podcast called The Shortest Distance Between Two Points is the Long Way Around. And it was about a chap by the name of B.H. Liddell Hart, who was he was in World War One. And all the lessons he took away from World War One about attrition warfare and the importance of flanking the enemy. Well, it's really that the art of indirect communication is actually really closely bound up with tactical empathy. And you're trying to maneuver to a position and be patient with it by letting the other party effectively tell you what's on their mind. It's almost like when you watch like Federer play tennis, it's like the other guy on the other end of the court always seems to be running around a lot more than he is. And it's like, just be patient, sit back, ask the questions, summarize it at the end. And once you've heard the words, that's right, you know that that's, you know, the key's actually been unlocked. You can actually have a lucid.
You've disarmed them. There's so many things from that really fascinating, deep explanation there, which I already wish I was armed with going back 10, 15 years, whatever it was now, to I think it was like 2011 or something like that when I was having those conversations, right? But
I'd like to say it was my own, you know, but it's not. We're all students of life, you know, and so we're always trying to learn. And for me, that was quite a life changing. The other thing, it was quite a life changing book. The other thing as well that he talked about, which actually is when you get to the stage where you can negotiate, where like, you're having reasonable discussions, reasonable, rational discussions. The other thing you talked about is the Ackerman model, which I've used quite a lot. And the Ackerman model effectively is you set a preconceived goal of what you would like to achieve in the negotiation, as in almost like the worst outcome that you could accept. And then what you do is your first offer that you make in the opposite direction effectively is like 65% of what that is. It's almost like when you're buying a house and you make that insulting first offer, it's probably not going to be accepted. If it is, you're like, oh my word, that's like the best outcome ever, but it's probably not going to be accepted. And then what you have is you have then ensuing offers of 85% of that, 95% of that, and obviously 100% is when you've, you know, that's kind of the last straw for you. But when you actually get to the outer edges of what you're willing to accept, it's quite interesting. Like you could say, okay, yeah, it's 65,000. No, it's case 85,000. It's 95,000. Often when I get to the 95,000, one of the features of the Ackerman model is we're going to call it £94,787.67. It sounds really exacting because the other party thinks, if they've come to that exact number, they've really actually done their science and they're probably not willing to go beyond it.
Yeah.
So the Ackerman model is quite useful as well. So what you kind of find is that you're pairing up all of these different skill sets and trying to exercise them to push a negotiation towards an agreeable outcome for both parties.
Like I said, there's just so many different things that stand out from what you said, you know, mirroring, labeling, key spokesperson, carefully framed statements. These are all things that I've written down, right? It might not be the most salient point from what you've said, far from it, but that key spokesperson point, is that something that you would say? Because, you know, so my experience, go back to that project, it was me, QS, project manager, and design manager that would often be in there with our counterparts. We never defined a key spokesperson. I might say, like at the start of it, look, on these variations, I'm going to speak about X, Y, and Z, and then maybe you take it on this bit. Why would you define a key spokesperson? And would you do that before a meeting?
Yeah, I think one of the benefits is that everyone has different skill sets. Let's say you have one person in your team that's really analytical and is good at like identifying salient points for you to draw out within that meeting. But let's perhaps say that person isn't naturally articulate in terms of expressing that viewpoint. But you might have a person in your team that's a really good talker and has a really affable demeanor. You know, they're really likable. Put the likable person at the front, and you know, you've got a clear mandate as a team of what you're trying to achieve. Okay, here's the intent of what we're trying to achieve. By having a spokesperson at the front who's like almost like a statesman type person, if you've got a good talker, put them in the talking position. It's like putting a striker in a position to score goals. It's like, put it in the net for us, you know? So I think that's what's quite useful about having a spokesperson. The other thing as well that just came to mind as well is knowing who the deal maker is on the other side of the table. That's really pivotal, because what you don't want to get from the opposing side is a false yes. You know, you can get a yes and then actually find, and I mean, the construction industry is notorious for false yeses. You get a yes, and you're like, 2 months later, they're like, never said that. And it's like, you so said that. But whereas if you actually find out who within the opposing forces is your deal maker, that means everything. Like, I remember I had one meeting where it became really apparent that there was one guy at the table who was the deal maker. And so all of my key points were diplomatically directed to that person, because I knew that if I got a yes from the person to his left or the person to his right, that was a yes that potentially could mean absolutely nothing
something.
When it came to implementation of the deal. So I think the deal maker is quite knowing who that is.
It's a bit like sales, right? That sales process where, you know, influencer,
true,
actual decision maker, like there's different people who you've got to convince along the way. And you don't think about it in that respect, because you think, well, it's just construction, it's just interim filing, because it usually gathers momentum, doesn't it, over time? And you end up over 6 months kind of entrenched in your respective positions, doesn't it? Because, you know, usually it might be just QS to QS, then eventually maybe the PM comes in, then maybe some directors come in, like, and it just becomes quite a convoluted process. So that really stuck out to me as a really, and it makes perfect sense, put the most amicable person, the most eloquent person in terms of language, put them front and center and tell everyone else to shut up, unless that person kind of is saying, what do you think about this?
Yeah,
Brian, I mean, what do you think? Like,
you'd be a good front man because you're a likable person and you're good at talking.
Stop it!
Yeah, well, they should have put you at the front in that on that difficult project, Paul.
Eventually.
Yeah, but I think the other thing as well, just to perhaps put a lid on that particular situation, is when I mentioned about the importance of framing statements. I think in any negotiation, emotional intelligence and the reading of body language is so important. Like, just understanding what makes the people around the room tick is pivotal. You know, I was just listening to your last episode where the chat that you were talking to, just before I logged on, I was listening to it.
Fully committed to Own the Build you are, right? Like,
absolutely.
Nobody I know.
Through and through. So he was talking about managing a team and what was important to his team from an emotional intelligence standpoint, and different things make different people tick, you know? And it's no different in a negotiation. In fact, it's probably equally or more important in a negotiation setting, because everything's heightened in a negotiation setting. And so when I was talking about framing statements, that's so important. Like, every word counts. And the way that I look at, like, framing statements, I almost look at it like preparing a meal for someone. What type of food does this person like? You know, do they like salt in it? Do they like pepper? You know, do they like, you know, chili? How do they like it? And in terms of actually framing statements, that's how I actually view it in my mind. I'm like, how would this land at the other end?
But
I'll tell you,
what I used to always do, and I used to be so meticulous about this, I would almost create a crib sheet, right, for everyone in the room. And that would be like, look, when we're talking about variation 46, these are the 8 points we're going to make. And they're the right ones. Because we would be on a project with 700 variations on our account and 150 not agreed, and 50 of them would be massive, right, in terms of it. And so I would create this crib sheet, but I would always frame that as in what is going to win me that argument technically or contractually, and like, that will be the knockout blow, which is why, so, you know, as you were talking there, I was making some notes. And framing a statement and serving them a meal that actually, so in going back to my example, I would create a crib sheet that would give me the perfect answer for technically and contractually what would win me the argument. But old no shoes, I would probably trigger him beyond all belief with some of those, because they'd have been the exact things that, for whatever reason, he thought were complete nonsense, whether true or do you see what I mean?
Whereas
you're actually doing is you're sprinkling a little bit of salt and pepper on it, or in your example where you're saying, it's almost like, these are our knockout blows, but I'm going to say it like this, because that will appeal, I think, in more, it will get me a garner a better conversation from person X or person Y, which I never did.
Yeah, and you could have... It's interesting because, like, if you have all your and by all means, so what you did in terms of the crib sheet, having your contractual house in order, absolutely, that's first and foremost, that has to be done. So what I'm not advocating is I'm not advocating not administering your contracts properly. You absolutely, first and foremostly, do that, because if you have the gun loaded full of contractual, all the chambers are loaded with contractual bullets, then that's a great place to start from, because you never actually have to wield the weapon per se. They know it. They know it's. It's there.
They don't care, though, do they? Guy did not care. Yeah, he would be reading a different contract to me. That's how it feels sometimes, right? I'm reading one contract, you're reading a different version. Like, it's got, you're reading it not with rose tinted glasses, with I don't know what tinted glasses, but so it doesn't matter.
Yeah,
having it, which is why it's really so important, that framing statement is what you say.
Yeah, sometimes you feel like you're dealing with contrarians, you know, where no matter which way or angle you come at it from, they've got an opposing answer, which is just the complete opposite by default. And so you do come across those people. But in principle, the way I always think about how I deliver the statements to the opposing party is, who do I deliver it to? As in, who is this going to sit best with or ring the most true with? And how do I frame that? So in a live setting, in a live negotiation setting, it's like, it can be like total madness in your own mind, because there can be a lot going on. It can be a busy environment. And so I think the more that you do it, the better you get at it. But it's not straightforward. And you are going to make mistakes. And when I say you, I mean me, you know, me, you know, I'm going to make mistakes. And so it's never too far gone. You can always recover it. And so just almost concede in your own mind that that's going to happen from time to time.
Yeah, but it totally resonates with me, because I'm going back to, I'm relitigating a lot of something which I can barely remember any of going back to this meeting now, but it's all coming kind of back to
and reread them.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me started.
You're going to go phone Mr. No Shoes and be like, I think we need to do this again.
yeah, come on. But the idea of the crib sheet to me was my way of just realigning, right? Because and that was emotional conversation, back and forth. We're talking about variation 57. I could just distill it down into 6 or 7 bullet points, which would just cut the noise out of it. But if it said to, like, and bullet point 8 was, and target this at person X and talk empathetically about situation Y, which they previously resonated with them, I think, like, that's like the cherry on the top, because that isn't something that I did. So it completely and utterly resonates with me. And you can see I'm enjoying just this conversation.
Made me think, actually. So just in mentioning that, something that I also just thought about that Chris Voss mentioned was learning how to say no without saying no. Because no is, it's almost like sometimes when someone says
no. Blunt instrument.
Yeah, it feels like blunt force trauma sometimes when you get hit with a no, you know, depending on the veracity or the emphasis behind that no. And quite often you can deliver a no without ever saying the word, and it can be along the lines of, thank you for your offer, but unfortunately we can't accept it because on this project we've lost the best part of £125,000, so we need to try and maneuver to a better position than that. So it's an indirect statement. It's not, you know, you've come around the side with the statement, and it doesn't
like jab back on the nose.
It's not like you've spurned their offer. It's been a polite delivery back in their direction to say, let's try again, you know? And so it's
subtleties. There's so much subtlety and nuance. And, you know, like I said, just listening to you now and talking this through, it's made me think I used to always feel quite confident, you know, like I said, going back to how I would approach a project, how would then, it was exactly the same to a meeting, right? I'd go to a final account meeting and I think I've got everything on it. I've spent the time, got my crib sheet. It's absolutely fine. But even just listening to you now, it does make you think how differently you could approach it with your team, with the people in the room. Say, look, you're amazing at this. You manage that part. You're good at this. You manage that part. This person will be the spokesperson. Let's think about this problem. And who have we spoken to on the project? And what was their feeling when we spoke to them? Well, you can't speak to him about it because he was the one that wrote that instruction. Or do you see what, like, there's so many different ways to frame it. And fascinating conversation. I guess to kind of wrap it up, this is why it's been such a good conversation. I haven't asked any of the questions that I wanted to ask in some ways, but that's why it's been good. So there'll be people listening to this show right now who will be looking at their diaries and thinking, oh, I've got that meeting with Billy No Shoes in my case, right? I've got that meeting in 3 days. I need to prepare for it, and I don't want it to go either how I think it will go or how that last meeting went, because that isn't getting me anywhere. In fact, it feels like it wasn't 1 step forward and 2 steps back. It was just 3 steps back, right? I mean, that is the feeling so often. Could you just describe what your approach and describe your advice? If it was me, right, and I said I've got this meeting with No Shoes, tell me how I should approach that meeting and why.
I think kind of the first thing that I naturally try and do is put time into the equation. So how much time do I have to prep for this? Because that can be quite important. If you know, it's, let's say if you have loads of time, your prep can feel almost endless. You've got loads of latitude to work with to put your preparation. But if you put time into the equation and you haven't got much of it, then you have to start looking at prioritizing what is the most important thing to do. So I think, I look at time, and then I look at thoroughly prepping an understanding of what my weaknesses are in the argument or the negotiation, because half the battle is having your arguments in return, having them preloaded and ready to go. And understand that, to me, that's equally as important as knowing what their weaknesses are. Sometimes I actually find that more important to me, because sometimes I've had negotiations where I've had overt weaknesses, but I've had to touch on theirs, and it's almost a bit of a smokescreen, you know, because you've got some stuff that you're like, you know, this could actually come a little bit unraveled. So it's just knowing what those weaknesses are and getting ready to defend those. And then, you know, if you've got a little bit of time and you've got someone, you know, let's say you're going to a negotiation with another party, you know, it might be worthwhile role-playing that negotiation. Just one round of role-playing that negotiation, if you know what the other parties are like. So let's say you got a really aggressive party on the other side of the table, and the other person can role-play being a really aggressive, unreasonable person. And it allows you just to feel the heat of that moment, so that when it actually happens live, you're like, oh, I've seen this before. You know, it's slightly different, but, you know, similar. And so I think that really helps. When you get into the negotiating environment or the difficult conversation, is do a lot of listening. So listen first, don't interrupt. I don't know if I cover the fact that Chris Voss says about asking how and what questions. Frame your questions with how and what, don't use why. And that's because why can, by its very nature, can sound accusatory. It sounds like you can be accusing the other party, albeit maybe even unwittingly, but the nature of the word is very different than how and what. Emotionally detach. So as soon as you get in that environment, have a preconceived agreement in your own mind that no matter what, you're going to keep you cool. Because if you've got a cool mind and a cool head, you're going to make much more clear-minded decisions in that environment.
And give the space to the other side to try and join you.
Yeah.
Join you there, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if the other side's totally losing their mind, let them lose their mind and look in that moment to think, how can I deconflict this situation? Or maybe sometimes actually let them feel the embarrassment of it. You know, it's like, there's nothing like a bit of silence every so often to bring the mood down in a room to sort of where it needs to be.
Yeah, yeah.
Something else is try and stay away from I statements, because it's a very opinion-based place to start. So, you know, I was talking about earlier about labeling and mirroring. So just trying to build the empathy. Be patient. Don't feel like you actually have to broker the negotiation or broker a deal in that negotiation within that meeting. Hopefully you've got enough space and time to maybe take away some stuff from that meeting if you feel like you're being pressured into a deal. And I think also the other thing as well that I always try and think about is minimum force applied. Can we win the battle without the other side even knowing there is a war? If you can get to that stage where you can get to an agreement without there ever being a cross word spoken, that's always the desired outcome. So minimum force applied. And, you know, as we were just talking about, is just building as much empathy as you can, building a relationship with the other party. One of the things I really try and major on is before I go into any form of negotiation, you know, sit down in a meeting, I just have a general chat with the party on the side. I'm like, how was your weekend? You know, did you do anything, get up to anything? Or if they come back from holiday, tell me about your holiday. It's like, it takes the eye off the ball. And also it immediately causes them to think you're a human being. You know, I'm not this thing on the other side of the table to be destroyed. I'm a human speaking to a human. And hey, why don't we just be humans? You know, and I think it's the mentality, like I alluded to in my blog, where sometimes we look at negotiations as in being sat on the opposite side of the table from a counterpart.
Satan.
Yeah, and they are the enemy. If you can get to the stage where it feels like you're sat on the same side of the table looking at a problem that's within your gift to solve between the two of you, that's the desired place to be. It's not looking at the other person like they're the problem. It's the thing you're negotiating over. That's the problem that can have a solution, or that you both have the capacity to get to a solution for. And I think if you get to the stage where you're at an adjudication, we've all failed. The hope is we can get there long in advance of that.
I completely agree with that as the sentiment. It goes back to like, what should be your objective from the start? It is to build that relationship. It's to have tactical empathy throughout the entire relationship, not just when you're at negotiating and dispute resolution, right? Almost, because
true.
That's kind of the goal. But it's honestly, This is probably one of our longest shows ever, if not the longest show ever. And you've just summarized really nicely. No, it's fantastic. I think people will have really enjoyed it. I certainly have. Like, the takeaways for me, tactical empathy, Christopher Voss, Never Split the Difference, a book to absolutely be read.
Yeah.
Key spokesperson, like going into meetings, knowing who that is, knowing exactly what your objective is in the meeting, mirroring, labeling, carefully framed statements on your crib sheets, not just your knockout, tactical, contractual and technical wins, and listening first. And honestly, I think there's so much more that we could discuss. There's so much more that you have talked about. I'll obviously share your details in the show, in the show notes, and I'll also be sharing your blog, as we will on the website. So thank you, Ray. Thank you ever so much for coming in. I've really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm sure everyone has enjoyed listening as well.
It's my pleasure.
We will be back next week, as always. Ray might even be listening then as well. I hope he still is. I will speak to you all next week, guys. Have a good weekend.